haven't lost Esther in your Bible, but we'll be able to turn back to it now. I want to turn this evening to a single study of this rather obscure book to many people. I suppose it is true, is it not? As Christians, we tend to neglect the book of Esther. Our Jewish friends could teach us a very great lesson in this connection, because they read through the book of Esther once a year at the feast they call Purim, which takes its origin probably from this particular book. It's held around this time of the year, in the last month in the Jewish calendar, and the month immediately before the month Nisan, in which the Passover is celebrated. And as they celebrate the Feast of Purim, Jewish people read through the whole of the story of Esther. And they do it in quite a dramatic form, because, of course, there are some characters who are immediately identifiable as the baddies in Esther, and they are booed, and the good parts are cheered. And I believe, although I've never been there, but I've spoken to Jewish friends who have, that it is an interesting experience. Now, the reason the Jews pay attention to the book of Esther is, of course, that it deals with a very vital and very ultimate question. And the question is, and it's a question which is relevant in our own age especially, who holds ultimate power in the struggling world in which we live? As you read the newspaper and listen to the news on television and see some of the agony and anguish and chaos and struggling for power in the world, the great question arises, who holds ultimate power in this strange world in which we live? Who is the ultimate authority? Who has the last word in all the affairs of men and nations, in all the strange ups and downs of history? Well, the book of Esther provides an answer to that question in what to me is a most thrilling and exciting way. You may know that it is the one book in the Bible where the name of God is never found. You will search in vain for God's name in the book of Esther, but that's not because he is not in the book. I think possibly the reason is that there is no place in the whole of this history which is unfolded where God is not to be found. And that's really, in a very real sense, the purpose and testimony of the book of Esther. And it is my hope that in this book we may find a most wonderful evidence of the greatness and goodness of God to his people, his constant sovereign care over his own, and the way that he works in history, sometimes even through the wrath and evil of men, to bring glory to his name and blessing to his own people. The whole book is, in a sense, really an illustration of the text in Romans 8:28, all things work together for good to them that love God, to them that are called according to his purpose. Well, now, if we are going to understand the book of Esther at all, we must first of all turn to a bit of history. Because you really can't understand Esther apart from the times in which she lived. Her real significance lies in the fact that she was caught up into a remarkable number of circumstances ordered by the hand of God so clearly, through which God was working. It really begins in the year 586, which was a low water mark in Israel's fortunes. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had swept down on Jerusalem, annihilating it. And this, having been long foretold by the prophets as God's great judgment on Israel, resulted in the taking away of captives to Babylon, the misery of which was expressed in all sorts of different ways, perhaps never so poignantly as in Psalm 137, where the psalmist cries out, "By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion, and their captives had taunted them. Sing us one of the Lord's songs," they said. "How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land?" they replied. They hanged their harps on the willows. But even in exile, God was there and had a purpose for them. This exile, which was part of God's judgment upon his rebellious, fractious, difficult people, was a period of time which was God's discipline, but God was right there in the middle of it. God had a purpose for his people there, and he would not give up his purpose. He was marching on as he is forever doing in history, inexorably carrying with him his own people into the perfections of his purpose. And you see the illustration of that in men like Daniel and his friends who were preserved by God even from the very mouths of lions. Well, some years after, in 539, Cyrus, the king of Persia, burst upon the world stage and he captured Babylon. So Israel's captors became captives, and Cyrus, the king of Persia, became their new lord and master. But Cyrus had no quarrel with the Jews, and he indeed proved to be God's instrument of working amongst them, and he allowed them to go back to their own land. A number of them did, a surprising number of them did not. They had this long, rigorous journey before them. To be sure, many of them had settled in the land of their exile and were now reluctant to leave it. One of these was Mordecai, who held a minor court appointment under Xerxes, who is called in the RSV anyway, Ahasuerus, the king at this time. He was in the capital, and we read of him in chapter 2 and verse 5. There was a Jew in Susa, the capital, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. So there is the first Jew we come across who is still here in captivity. And another was a little orphan girl who was a cousin of Mordecai. Her name is Adassah, and that was her Jewish name, but her Persian name was Esther, which means a star. Hadassah means myrtle, simply. So her Jewish name was Myrtle. Her Persian name was Esther. But she is the cousin of Mordecai, as we read in verse 7. He had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The maiden was beautiful and lovely. Remember that, because it's going to become very important just shortly. The maiden was beautiful and lovely, and when her father and mother died, Mordecai adopted her as his own daughter. Well, Mordecai brought Esther up, and they too become very important figures in the story of the book of Esther. Other dramatis personae, as they might be called, are Xerxes, Ahasuerus, a rather greedy tyrant to whom the lives of his subjects seemed to be rather unimportant, and Vashti, his queen, of whom we read in chapter 1. And thirdly, Haman, a senior statesman, kind of prime minister probably, and a man who really was not a true Persian, but an Amalekite, and therefore a bitter enemy of the Jews. So here you have, in the court, occupying a minor position, Mordecai the Jew, and occupying a major position, Haman, the governor, the prime minister, who was strongly anti-Semitic. The real story of the book opens in the year 483 with a huge feed that we read of in chapter 1 for the governors of 127 provinces of Persia. And it seemed that this area stretched for a vast distance. It was really a massive empire. And King Ahasuerus had them all brought together, all these governors from 127 different provinces, and he had them brought together for these 180 or so days in order that they might have the opportunity of seeing his power. And it seems to have been a characteristic of ancient monarchs. They delighted to show off the greatness of their wealth, the greatness of their might and power. It was a bit like May Day in Red Square, I suppose, as they had going on for 180 days. Can you imagine it? And there he was displaying all his power to these 127 governors. King Ahasuerus, and doubtless many of his guests, got thoroughly drunk and thoroughly stupid, as people do get when they're thoroughly drunk. And he decided on a rather odd and degrading piece of amusement, or perhaps of self-boasting. That was that he was going to show off Vashti, his queen, who was apparently a beautiful woman, to his guests. And so he sent these men in chapter 1, verse 10, but to bring, verse 11, Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to behold. And you can imagine the picture of this drunken assembly with the king suddenly saying, I'll tell you what we'll do, we'll have Queen Vashti brought on to show these guests of mine this beautiful queen. But Queen Vashti tossed her head in the air, as any decent woman would have done, and refused to show herself off to this drunken lot. And she told them, go back and tell him what I said. And she refused to come. King Ahasuerus thereupon threw a tantrum. He was not used to being treated like that, and more especially by a woman. And so all his nobles began to urge the king. This deed of the queen, verse 17, will be made known to all women, causing them to look with contempt upon their husbands, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. They said, my lord, this is going to be a bad day for the noble male, and you really must do something about it. So Vashti was banished from the palace. She lost her job as the queen, and that meant that there was no queen on the throne. Now, instead of finding a successor in the normal way, they decided to find a new queen by a rather novel method. A rather extraordinary one. And chapter 2 is really the story of this. They decided to hold a beauty contest. And this is where Esther comes in. Yes, it's really true. You read it here in chapter 2. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of the kingdom to gather them together to Susa, the capital, and then let their ointments be given them, and the maiden who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. Well, this is where Esther comes into the picture, because Esther, who we read was fair and beautiful, was one of those who was brought in to this occasion. And it appears that Esther was a total knockout, and the king chose her, and All the others were left standing, and she became the queen. Now, one of the early events of her reign was a plot to assassinate King Ahasuerus. And the plot was really in the hands of two assassins who rejoiced in the rather odd names of Bigthan and Teresh. And Mordecai, Esther's cousin, you will remember, heard of this, the end of chapter 2, verse 22. This came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and Esther, and he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of Chronicles in the presence of the king. That means it was written in the history books, and that also is a matter of profound importance as the story unfolds. So that's chapters 1 and 2. Haman then comes into the story at this point. Haman appears to have been a man who was particularly addicted to vanity. He was a man who had an uncommon sense of ambition, driving ambition, so that people might begin to bow down before him. And so he was promoted in verse 3, as many of these pushing people are. He was promoted in chapter 3, verse 1, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and did obeisance to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. Quite possible that Haman had persuaded him that this was the kind of thing to be done for someone of his rank. But, and here is the significant thing, Mordecai, the end of verse 2 of chapter 3, did not bow down or do obeisance. Haman, of course, was profoundly upset. And he determined not only to crush Mordecai, but to crush the whole of the Jewish people represented by Mordecai. And he has a law passed to this end. In chapter 3, verse 8, then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people, that is the Jews, God's people, scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not for the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed. And just in case the king might waver, he puts in a little bit of bribery into the bargain, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, and said to Haman, the money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you. So Haman started this persecution of the Jews. Now, Mordecai obviously had his ear to the ground, and this document which went out came to the ears of Mordecai, and he gathered all that Haman was purposing to do against the Jews. And chapter 4 tells us what he did. When he learned all that had been done, Mordecai rent his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city, wailing with a loud and bitter cry. And he came up to the gates of the palace, and some of Esther's servants had gone down to the gate of the palace, and they came back up again, and they said to her, Your Majesty, there's a queer-looking fellow who's standing down at the gate of the palace, shampooing his hair with ashes and with sacks worn all round his shoulders, and he looks a bit like that cousin of yours, Mordecai. So Esther said, Go and take a message to him, and she took a message to him, and he came back again, the messenger, and began to tell Mordecai what it was that, to tell Esther what it was that had happened. Mordecai says to her, You, even you, Esther, will not be safe in all of this, because you will die in this purge of the Jews. And he now brings her to see where God's hand may well have led her in her life. And what he is saying to her in verse 14 of chapter 4, the verse we mostly know in Esther, is this: if you keep silence, she said, if I go into the king's presence, the king only admits those he has called. I haven't been called, and unless the king is favorably disposed towards me, I'll lose my life. And Mordecai says, if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter. Do you notice that in verse 14? Mordecai says, Esther, God is not ultimately going to be dependent on you. If you refuse the will and purpose of God for your life, his purposes will not be thwarted. He will simply bypass you. But he says, God has a purpose for you. Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom and been put in that position precisely for a time like this? And Esther acknowledges that it may be true and asks the messenger to reply to Mordecai, take word back to him and ask them to come before God, which is what fasting was about on my behalf. And they did. Well, now, the drama really begins to increase in chapter 5, because Esther goes into the king's presence. And as she approaches him, and it seems to have been true that exactly what she said normally happened, that if someone had not been called into the king's presence, they could easily have been killed immediately for their impertinence in approaching him. But as she came, in verse 2, and here again, do you see where God is in all of this? Keep thinking of that principle. When the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she found favor in his sight, and he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand, which was the sign of favor. Then Esther approached and touched the top of the scepter, and the king said to her, what is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you, even to the half of my kingdom. Now, Esther obviously was something of a diplomat, however short a time she had been in the court, because far from beginning immediately by saying, well, now the Jewish people of whom I am a representative are in trouble and I want you to come and save them, she said, would you come to dinner with me, with Haman, today, for I have prepared it for you and for Haman. And in verse 5, the king said, bring Haman quickly, that we may do as Esther desires. So they come to dinner, and Haman undoubtedly thinks that he has been preferred, and that here is a moment of special glory for him. And he comes into the queen's presence and dines with the king in the queen's company. And Haman went home and was very glad. Now, the queen again, at the evening, was asked by the king, what is your petition? It shall be granted to you. Verse 6, and what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled. But Esther said, my petition and my request is this. Verse 7 of chapter 5. And instead of saying again, will you help my nation because they're in great danger? Whether she lost confidence at that point or not, we don't know, but she said, would you come and have dinner again tomorrow? And the king said, we will. And Haman thought it was still more wonderful. Here was not only the one invitation to go and dine in the palace, but another one following upon it. So Haman goes away. And he is very pleased, except for one thing, and that is for Mordecai. Because while he is rejoicing in the favor he has, in verse 13 of chapter 5, we read, yet all this does me no good, he says. That is, this invitation today and tomorrow, it does me no good so long as I see Mordecai, the Jew, sitting at the king's gate. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends, that's Haman's wife, and all their friends said to him, Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go merrily with the king to dinner. Delightful wives these people have. She said, when he said to her, What shall I do about Mordecai? Can you imagine it, darling? She said, Have him hanged. Well, there King Ahasuerus thought this was a very good thing. Haman thought this was a very good thing to do. And he made a gallows at the back of his house. And that seemed to be threatening for Mordecai. But then the remarkable thing happens at the beginning of chapter 6. And that is that very night. Now, why that particular night? Chapter 6, verse 1 is very significant. On that night, the king could not sleep. Now, you've got to remember the rest of the history to see the point of this. The king could not sleep. He lay awake, suffered from insomnia probably, that particular night. It seems this wasn't general, but that particular night. Now, what do you do when you suffer from insomnia? Some of us go downstairs and have a cup of tea. Perhaps you try to read a book. Well, Haman, Ahasuerus, was one of those who tended to read a little. And what more likely to put a man to sleep than the long history of his nation? And so he said, Get out the history books and read before the king. So in chapter 6, verse 1, he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. Now guess where they read? They read the story to King Ahasuerus, which described how Mordecai had found out the plot which had been made by Bigthan and Teresh against the king's life. And as he was dropping off to sleep, Ahasuerus picked up his ears and he said, Now I remember that. He said, What did we do for Mordecai to reward him for this deed? And they said, Nothing, my lord. Nothing has been done for him. Chapter 6, verse 3. And the king said, Who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace because he was planning the hanging of Mordecai that very day. It was obviously near dawn. And the gallows had been prepared for him. So the king's servants told him, verse 5, Haman is there standing in the court. And the king said, Let him come in. And he had a talk with Haman. And he said to Haman, Now, what should we do for the man the king desires to favor? If there was a man that the king desired to bless and honor and favor, what would we do with him? And Haman immediately, of course, thought of himself. And he said, Well, I should think we ought to have a royal procession for him to honor him, and a crown on his head, nothing spared, he said. You can read of it from verse 7 onwards. Haman said to the king, For the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought which the king has worn, and the horse the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set, and let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes. Let him array the man whom the king delights to honor, and conduct him on horseback through the open square of the city, proclaiming before him, Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. What vanity the man had, really. Quite extraordinary. But the king turned to Haman and said, Good. You get Mordecai and do that for him. And Haman, as you can imagine, dissolved in anguish. Now, don't forget that Queen Esther still had her second banquet to come, her second dinner. She had invited them to the one, and now there was still the second. And at the second banquet, which takes us into chapter 7, Esther is asked by the king what it is that she really wanted. And Haman is sitting there, remember. Chapter 7 begins, the king and Haman went in to feast with Queen Esther. And on the second day as they were drinking wine, the king again said to Esther, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled." And she says, "My lord, let my people be saved." She prays the king for her people, because we have been sold merely as slaves, men and women. I would have held my peace, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king. I and my people are to be destroyed, slain, annihilated, she says. And then King Ahasuerus says to Esther, "Who is the evil genius who has thought up that scheme?" And Esther points along the table. "Him," she says. And that's Haman. Now, the king, of course, is so annoyed that in chapter 7, verse 7, you will read, he had to go out into the garden to cool off. The king rose from the feast in wrath and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. And when the king came back in again, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was, the king said, "Will he even assault the queen in my presence in my own house?" As the words left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then said Harbona, one of the king's servants, and there's always somebody who's standing near with some suggestion to make like this. He said, "My lord, have you been wondering what to do with Haman?" And the king said, "Yes, as a matter of fact, I have." "Well," he said, "now just in Haman's back garden, there's the most magnificent gallows that he has built." That's exactly what he says. And he said, "Hang him there." And the king said in verse 10, "Hang him on that." So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai. Esther now asks the king that the Jews may defend themselves against their enemies. And the king holds out the golden scepter again to Esther. And Esther is given the opportunity, really, of writing whatever kind of law and bill she desires for the prosperity and blessing of God's people. And Mordecai is raised to a position of great authority. And God's people are honored in a remarkable way. Now, what are the things that are really significant in all this story? Because the story is there for a purpose, you will notice. Some of it is written with a brilliant sense of irony. But the story is all there for a purpose. And the purpose of it is what we need to grasp as we draw this to a conclusion. What are the things that really matter in all this? Number one, God's sovereign control over the whole of history and over the lives of his people and even over the lives of his enemies. God's sovereign control. That's the great lesson that the book of Esther exists in the Bible to teach us. As I was saying earlier, you can comb the book of Esther and nowhere find the name of God. But the reason is that in every situation, in every crisis, in every circumstance, in every evil device that evil men think up, in every plight of his people, in every tear they shed, in every anguish they go through, God is there. That's the message of the book of Esther. There is not a shadow falls upon one of God's beleaguered children, but God knows it and God cares about it. And even at times when it seems as if there is no sign of God in the midst of this situation, that is perhaps when he is most at work. Do you know the line of that hymn which says, "He hides himself so wondrously, as though there were no God. He is least seen when all the powers of ill are most abroad." There is a plan which is being sovereignly carried through in this book of Esther. and ultimate power, you see. Ultimate power belongs not to the king who abused it, nor to Haman who lusted after it in his vanity, nor even to Queen Esther who seemed somehow to inherit it and be wedded to it. Ultimate power in this whole situation belonged to Jehovah. It was the Lord who was ruling over these nations. It was the Lord who was raising up kings and casting them down. It was the Lord who was taking the evil devices of men and bringing them to nothing in a way that brought him glory. That's the message of the book of Esther. The hand which controls the situation is God's. And Esther's significance is that she is caught up into the purposes of this sovereign God. And that is true of every single one of God's children. No matter how lowly and meek, no matter how small and insignificant, the glory of Christian experience is that when you put your trust in Jesus Christ, you are caught up into the purposes of the God who is ruling the universe, to whom all power belongs. I'm going to be for a very short time in New York next month, and somebody said to me, you will need to go to the United Nations building, the seat of international power, you know. Well, no, I don't think I'm going to have time to go to the United Nations building, but it doesn't really worry me very much, because that's not the seat of international power at all, you see. The seat of international power is the throne of the Lord God Omnipotent, who reigns forever and ever and will never abdicate his throne. And when you are caught up into the purposes of such a God as that, it does two things for you which it did for little Esther, this insignificant orphan girl. It gives to your life significance. That's what it did for her. It raised her to a place of significance. Who knows whether you are not come to the kingdom for such a time as this, says Mordecai to her. Who knows what the significance of your life might be if you're ready to trust the God of your fathers? It brought her significance. The real significance of this girl, you see, was not that she was a queen. The real significance was that she was in God's place at God's time, doing God's will. And that adds a dimension to life, you know. I find there are so many people who are searching for significance, for meaning, for purpose, for some real point to life in these days. People find it. I notice this when I'm talking with people about their jobs. What's the real significance of my job? I find it frequently with people who are coming into middle life. What have I been doing, they say? What have I been doing with my life? What have I contributed sometimes to society, to the world? And they're searching for significance, you see. There was a very interesting study in that Now magazine some time ago. A very interesting study of the reasons why people gave themselves to social and relief work. Now, you will not misunderstand me and imagine that I am decrying that. I think that it is a great and glorious thing when people give themselves to that. What I want to say to you is this, though. They had recognized that the reason many people gave themselves to that kind of work was that they wanted to prove that their lives had significance. And oh, my friends, why that is there in your heart is it is an answer to what the Lord God has created in your bosom, a desire to be in the will of God. That's what the hearts of men are aching for. And little Esther found it. Who knows whether you are not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? It gave a new significance to her, and it gave a new security to her. Nothing could touch her, you see, while she was in the hollow of Jehovah's hand. Not Haman with all his evil designs. Not all the laws of kings and empires. Nothing could touch her. She proved it so often as she went into the king's presence and found the golden rod extended towards her. Nothing could touch her. That sovereignty extends over every area of life, you know. I was speaking to someone a little while ago who was going back to a missionary situation where there is all kinds of danger, great deal of peril, bodily peril, I mean that his life could so easily be at stake. And he said to me before he went back, well, he said, you know, the deepest conviction I have is that I am immortal until my work is done. And that's it. And it extends over monarchs and politicians and evil men as well as God's people, over the whole range of life. God's perfect sovereignty. The second great lesson of Esther is God's perfect timing. That's the really striking thing in this book. Who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And all through the book of Esther, you get illustrations of that. That's why I was at such pains to go through these chapters with you again and again and again. God chooses the time. God makes the moment. God creates the coincidences. That night, the king could not sleep. Why that night? Because God kept him awake. That's why. And God's timing is perfect in every detail of this. Do you ever worry about God's perfect timing for your future, for your job, for your marriage, for your illness, maybe? Now, I know that it's a very easy thing for those of us who are well to speak to those of us who are ill, or those of us who are married to speak to those who are not yet married, but I want to say to you this evening, with the most glorious, utter, and absolute confidence, you can put these issues into the hands of the Lord God Omnipotent who reigns. And you will find that His will, like His timetable, is perfect. He not only never mistakes anything in His purpose, He never makes mistakes in His timing. And that's a vital lesson for us to learn. God's perfect timing. That's what makes me so encouraged about these days, you know, as I find God drawing men and women, young men and women, to Himself. There is a significance in the timing of everything. Who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Have you this sense of destiny, my dear Christian friend, throbbing through your being, that you are taken up into the steps and purposes of God, like Esther was? And maybe you need to allow some Mordecai to ask you, what about the timing of God? What about the kingdom? Who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Here's the last thing I want to say. God's perfect sovereignty. God's perfect timing. And thirdly, God's unlikely instruments. This poor little girl, Esther, was such an unlikely instrument. An orphan girl, an immigrant in the country, brought in under a real cloud with less than full status. And yet, God had a destiny for her. And the vital thing is that she was ready to risk everything on God's sovereign wisdom and purpose. Have you begun to do that, I wonder, yet? Do not ever say before God, no matter what your position is, "Oh, I'm such an unlikely person. All right for so-and-so. I'm glad to look on and see somebody else." You often think of an individual, but not someone like me. My dear friend, there is not one of us who is outside of this blessed purpose of the sovereign God to use us in a world like ours today with all its evil and iniquity. Someone has so wisely said, "What matters to God is not our ability or our inability, but our availability." And that's what really does count. I find it very thrilling to think what God might yet have to do through some of you, you know, here this evening. Does it ever catch your heart? Doesn't matter what present situation you are in, however unlikely, however disappointing it may be. Oh, the sense of destiny, the breaking of a dawn, the signs of God's hand moving. What a thing to be caught up into the purposes of such a God. And let me say this as we finish, what a thing to be outside of his perfect will, without Christ, without that destiny and hope. I pray, God, that you may get right into it this very night. Let us pray together.